Case 22-5232, Nicholas Morrow versus Metropolitan Government of Nashville and Davidson County, Tennessee et al. 15 minutes for the plaintiff, 15 minutes to be shared by the defendants. Mr. Justice, you may proceed for the appellant.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Drew Justice for the plaintiff appellant, Nicholas Morrow. I'll reserve 4 minutes. And I'm going to do my best to try to cover both the Fourth Amendment and false imprisonment issues in this argument. For the Fourth Amendment, that right was violated because the police intruded upon a home without exigent circumstances and also without probable cause more generally. There was no exigency because the one person who the police supposedly feared might be in danger, namely the professor and or possibly his students, were not present at the scene and could not have been harmed, at least not in any immediate way. There was no probable cause more generally because the reasons...
But I mean, let's just work through that. I mean, in their minds, the exigency is that someone is unstable and they're worried might have a weapon. And is the theory that if the most likely victims aren't right there, you don't have to worry about it? I mean, someone who you're inclined to think could shoot somebody, and you may think these are the 15 people most at risk... Are the police really allowed to say the rest of the world's not at risk? That strikes me as a kind of a dangerous way to think about it.
Well, there really was no rest of the world because the police didn't have any reason to think anyone else was inside the home, and in fact, no one else was inside the home. And in O'Brien versus City of Grand Rapids from this court, the court did embrace exactly the type of theory that I'm promoting here, which is that... you know, if there's no potential victims around for him to shoot, and basically just no one, if there's no potential victims around for him to shoot, then there is no exigency, or at least that
strongly.
Didn't
they fear that he might harm himself?
They did not fear that he would harm himself, Your Honor, and specifically, in every single one of their answers, I believe it's on paragraph 23, they all said that they didn't know of any accusations that he was in danger of any harm to himself, and then we specifically asked them about that in depositions too, and there's just never any allegation about him being suicidal or anything along those lines.
Although didn't a family member call the police saying she was worried that he was mentally having a crisis and there were guns in the house?
There was... some sort of distant relative from another state who made some comments to the police just about him having a crisis. I don't think that it was specific about him either trying to hurt himself or hurt any specific person. It was more just that she was concerned that he was acting strange.
And in connection with that, mentioned that there were guns in the house.
Right, and I don't think that that's really disputed, that the police understood that there was at least one gun in the house. But our contention is if he's not suicidal, then and if there's no one in there who he's supposedly threatening or a danger to, then it's just not, what is the danger? What is the emergency? And what stopped the police?
How could they know whether he's suicidal or not unless they actually went up to the house and tried to speak with him?
Well, I mean, it's ultimately up to the police to know, to have some reasonable basis for... you know, supported by specific articulable facts for thinking that he's a danger to himself. And if they just don't have anything, I'd say it's their burden to produce that defense to the Fourth Amendment.
His posting on the Facebook while in the house, you don't think that was enough?
No, because in his posting to Facebook never said anything about him wanting to hurt himself or hurt anyone else for that matter.
But it gave a time, right? Didn't he give a time, 4 p.m. or something?
He gave a time saying that change was coming at 4 p.m., and then the only reason why that somehow got connected to any kind of threat or danger at all was because he had supposedly, there was a girl who heard from someone, she didn't hear it herself, but heard that he had threatened the professor in some way 2 weeks before. However, she didn't know specifically what the threat was. She didn't really know that it even happened at all because she didn't see it happen. It happened 2 weeks before, meaning it was...
Why didn't he just say when they came and he goes outside, why didn't he just say, hey, there's just been some confusion here. I'm announcing my run for governor. That's what I was posting about, and they're all confused, and please leave me alone. I want to get back to starting my race to be governor.
Well, I don't think he knew specifically. I mean, I don't think he would have even known specifically what their thought process is, because they haven't communicated it to him. But he did post various political ideas about how the police are corrupt, the VA is corrupt, the Auto Masters company, which was one of his former employers, was corrupt and working with the police. He talked about the Codes Commission, which I think was kind of nutty, but I mean, he said that was a problem.
What do you think the police should have done that they differently? Do you think they should have just ignored this completely and not done anything to respond to these concerns that they'd heard from others?
I think there's a good argument to be made that they should have ignored it completely. However, I would say definitely once they learned that there was, the only connection at all between what he had posted and any possible threat was this 4 p.m. thing, which was supposedly coincided with an exam he was going to take on a Sunday afternoon with that professor whom he had maybe threatened 2 weeks before. The connection was very tenuous to begin with, but once the police learned that there was no exam, that there was no exam at 4 p.m., no school at all on a Sunday afternoon, I would say that they should have disregarded it at that point. If they did want to pursue it further, then there are other non-emergency types of committal alternatives that they could have pursued under state law. But I don't think they're just allowed to, camp out inside his backyard, camp out in the curtilage of his home, arrest him on his back porch without a warrant, any of that.
What do you make about the world we're living in? Yeah, I mean, a week doesn't go by where you don't have some problem that invariably is someone has a mental health problem and has guns. I mean, that's just, you don't go a week without that happening in this country. Every time we then hear that there were red flags here, there were red flags there after the fact. I mean, I sure have some sympathy with police officers taking risks themselves, right? The safer thing to do is not go confront somebody who seems to be having a mental health episode and has access to weapons. So they're clearly are thinking about the community when they do this. Don't you think it's easy to understand why they would think this is appropriate?
Well, I mean, they're thinking about the community, but ultimately they're thinking about the community doesn't allow them to override the Fourth Amendment. And so they're allowed to go up on the home, to the front porch, not the back, the front, politely knock, wait to be received, and if they're not received, leave. And that's talked about in Florida versus Hardiness. And so I would say that's what they should have done if they wanted to try to make further contact with him.
They should have just left, just don't even stay outside his house.
I think that they could, probably be justified in staying out on the front, on the street, but not in his backyard, not turning off his air conditioner, not going to his back porch, any of that, all of which they did, and they just camped out for 4 or 5 hours. And, I mean, ultimately, the thing is, 4 or 5 hours, that's enough time to get some sort of order from a judge if it's really justified. And the fact that they didn't do that just shows that they didn't have any exigent circumstances. I did want to talk about, in terms of the Metro liability, I would just submit that they've admitted that all these actions were taken according to policy. I'd say their policy is either facially unconstitutional or that the unconstitutional consequences were obvious because their policy requires them to, without exception, interview someone, whether he wants to or not, obey the directives of a group of psychologists who are not judges, but regardless of whether those directives actually give any probable cause. Here the writ from the psychologist just said he's threatening to bring change at 4 p.m. It didn't even mention any violence, and it didn't even specifically say to hospitalize him. It just said, hey, I want to talk to him, bring him in for an interview. And then three, they're required to restrain anyone, meaning arrest anyone that they are transporting for mental health purposes. So I would just submit that this was all done by policy, which so
this,
was...
This last one is state law, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So what, am I right that some state law claims the district court decided not to review?
That is correct, yes. Yes.
So, I don't see that very often. You rule on the federal claim. You have to do that if there's jurisdiction. And the classic move, if you reject the federal claim, is to send all the state claims back to state court. And this particular one, it seems like a very good one for the state courts to look at.
It does seem a little weird. I didn't really think much about that, but yes, sir, you're right. But
is that raised below?
No, not especially. I just said in my brief, I just said that if we do overturn at least one federal issue, then I'd like the state claims reinstated that have been dismissed for lack of jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. But I would just say that, under the Tennessee Constitution and case law, a judicial commissioner who's unelected is not considered to be either a judge or a court. The statute involved here specifically uses the word court and judge of the general sessions.
Was this something out of the ordinary for a judicial commissioner to sign an order like this?
In Nashville, I don't think it's out of the ordinary. As far as I know, it's not done elsewhere. But, I mean, yes, that does seem to be a Nashville custom that they just...
Well, wasn't the university hospital entitled to rely on that custom, even if it was, technically... So let's assume you're right that it was technically not lawful. Did the hospital have any basis to question that?
Well, I think they're just they're required to obey the law, and if an order is facially without jurisdiction, then they're not allowed to obey it, regardless of whether that's something that they do hundreds of other times.
Is this the first suit that's ever raised this issue that you know of?
That I know of, yes, sir.
Okay.
Anyway,
I'll get your rebuttal.
All right, thank you all.
Okay, we'll hear from the other side. I don't know who's going first here. Okay.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Will Ayers for the Nashville Police Officer Defendants as well as the City of Nashville. This court should affirm the district court's grant of summary judgment to the officer defendants and the
Can
city
I just ask
Nashville.
You why the state law claim, one state law claim was reviewed but not the others? Do you have a sense of how that happened?
I could only speculate that that's because as to the defendant Vanderbilt, those were the only claims in this lawsuit, whereas as to the defendant, the city of Nashville, there were both federal and state law claims.
Interesting. Okay. All right.
So the district court correctly found that Mr. Morrow's First and Fourth Amendments were not violated and thus correctly declined to find municipal liability for the city and declined to exercise supplemental jurisdiction over the state law trespass claims. Now, I'd like to go into the Fourth Amendment unlawful entry claim, specifically Mr. Morrow's argument that the officer defendants lacked exigent circumstances to enter and remain in his yard without a warrant. What we had here was an ongoing exigency where the police were responding to Mr. Morrow's house to mitigate and assess a threat that came in via two separate 911 calls. Mr. Morrow refused to engage. The police had information that he was armed, that he had a past history of barricaded armed encounters with police at his house, that he suffered from mental illness, and so they reasonably set up a perimeter to ensure that Mr. Morrow didn't harm any bystanders or officers on the scene.
Just out of curiosity, why isn't that just the answer? Leave it at that. I mean, even if you think someone's potentially suicidal or you know nothing about suicidal, you just know they're having a mental health crisis and they have access to guns, I could imagine an approach that just says, hey, we're just going to make sure, as long as no one else is there, we're just going to stay here and make sure we follow him if he leaves. But our coming there is just as likely to precipitate something with a negative outcome as it is if we stay back. And why wouldn't that be a good choice?
Well, as Captain Widener, the commanding officer on the scene, testified, the whole intent behind this interaction was to speak with Mr. Morrow and ascertain what, if any, threat he posed to others and what has
been. That creates quite a hole in the Fourth Amendment. If every time the officers have something they'd like to learn from the homeowner, they get to go in. I don't think we would I don't think that works by itself anyway.
Well, it's important to note that the police did not enter Mr. Morrow's home. They did enter the backyard, and they established a perimeter, and the purpose of that was to prevent harm to bystanders. And that brings up a similarity.
They had a fear he was going to just open a window and start shooting people?
There is testimony from Captain Widener that he was concerned about children being on the street. It was a Sunday afternoon. It was a nice spring day. There's actually an entry in the dispatch call text that said there was an ice cream truck on the street at about 8 p.m., which is about 30 minutes before Mr. Morrow was detained. Captain Widener was concerned about the risk of harm to officers on the scene and bystanders. There was also a mobile command center set up a few houses down the street. Captain Widener testified that people were coming out of houses and asking what's going on here. So there were people in the area. They knew Mr. Morrow was armed. They were concerned that if shooting should break out, that someone could be hurt. And that's a key similarity to the Bing versus City of Whitehall case that we cite in our briefing. It's a very good roadmap for this court's analysis of the exigency issue. Because in this court in Bing found that a very similar standoff situation that lasted several hours, there was an exigency. Because what the court found is that just because time passes, that doesn't negate an exigency. The exigency ends when the factors that combine to create it are negated. And the court found that in Bing, because the officers were involved in an investigation, gathering information, confirming information, and creating a plan to respond to the incident, that did not negate the exigency. And that's exactly what happened here. Throughout the entire course of this event, the police were gathering information, both on the scene and off the scene. They were speaking to witnesses. Mobile crisis was involved. The police were sharing information back and forth with mobile crisis. They were trying to get in touch with Mr. Morrow. Mr. Morrow testified that his intent was not to say a word the entire time. And in fact, his behavior during the incident was entirely consistent with the behavior that precipitated the police response in the first place. He carried on posting about bizarre topics, and as Your Honor asked before, or mentioned before, had he just taken a moment to even post on Facebook, "Hey, just kidding, big misunderstanding here, I'm not going to hurt anybody," the whole situation might well have dissolved and there would have been no need, but he never did that. He never said a word. And so the police had no reason to assume that he was not a threat. And this really goes to the reasonableness of the police response. Mr. Morrow seeks to put this incident in a light through hindsight. But as this court knows very well, that's not the proper lens. The proper lens is the standard of an objectively reasonable officer on the scene, considering the totality of the circumstances. And if anything, the information that officers were gathering throughout the evening made the situation even more concerning. For example, when Mr. Morrow's mother showed up on the scene around about 7 o'clock, she told officers in mobile crisis that there were, in fact, loaded guns in the house. There was a shotgun with two boxes of ammunition in Mr. Morrow's room. She told them that he had told her to leave the house for whatever it was he was going to do that afternoon. He'd never done that before. The mobile crisis counselor perceived that Ms. Morrow was concerned about her son. And that's just one example of the information that kept coming in throughout the whole incident that increased the exigency. And there was no reason for the police to doubt the credibility of the witnesses. There's no indication.
How long did the police stake out the scene before they went up to try to talk to him?
They knocked on the door almost immediately. They arrived there at about 4:30. And then Mr. Morrow was detained at about 8:30. So the entire incident lasted about four hours.
They knocked on the door when they first got there. He didn't answer, and so then they just waited for a while, and then they went up again later?
They waited. They contacted Mobile Crisis, and during that time, Mobile Crisis was trying to reach Mr. Morrow by phone. His family members were trying to reach him by phone. So throughout the incident, it wasn't as if the officers just knocked and no answer and then they just gave up. There was a constant attempt to communicate with him and to see what was going on with him. I'd like to say a couple words about the municipal liability claim. The most efficient course of action is for this court to find that there was no constitutional violation, which takes care of the municipal liability claim. But assuming for the sake of argument that this policy were facially unconstitutional, first, Mr. Morrow has not challenged this policy on a facial basis. And second, the hypothetical that he advances did not happen here, so he can't show that the policy caused any deprivation. The hypothetical that he puts forth is that the policy requires officers to detain somebody without probable cause. So, for example, let's say a mental health professional just puts false information down on a 6401 form, and the police use that form to go detain somebody. Well, that didn't happen here. The record is full of evidence that shows that the police on their own had probable cause based on the information they had gathered. So, in other words, even if mobile crisis wasn't there, the officers had probable cause to detain Mr. Morrow for a mental health evaluation. So there's no causal chain between the policy and any constitutional deprivation. I'd also like to say a few words to distinguish the O'Brien case that Mr. Morrow relies on. O'Brien is distinguishable for at least four material reasons. The first is that it wasn't a mental health detention case, and so it lacks the extra dimension that was present here, where the officers were trying to connect and communicate with Mr. Morrow to find out what was happening. So in other words, this wasn't a criminal investigation. It was a mental health exigency. The other three distinctions are factual. The first one is that in O'Brien, there was an extended period where police were doing essentially nothing for roughly 4.5 hours. The court in Bing found this material for distinguishing O'Brien. Second, there was testimony from the officers in O'Brien that they did not perceive the plaintiff to be a threat to anyone over the course of roughly 6 hours. And finally, in O'Brien, the officers had cleared the scene of bystanders. It was also a residential area, but there was no concern that anyone could be hurt in a crossfire should something go sideways. Contrast that to here, where there were bystanders. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Ayers. We'll hear from Ms. Tipton. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Ashley Tipton on behalf of Vanderbilt University Medical Center. As this court is well aware, we are here on summary judgment from the District Court of Middle District of Tennessee, where Vanderbilt was granted summary judgment on plaintiff's false imprisonment and negligence per se claims.
How did you escape the state law thing?
I'm also going to...
I assume you're pretty comfortable with where things are, but because you won... is the point I'm getting at, but I just, how did it happen?
I'm going to speculate, as Mr. Ayers did as well. The order granting Vanderbilt's summary judgment motion was rendered a few months prior to any issue with Metro, so I'm assuming it was just kind of going through the motions of dealing with the Vanderbilt claims were easier to deal with, they got them disposed of, and then
nice
moved on to the Metro.
Your argument by saying your claims are easier to deal with. That's very clever. of course you would get rid of those right away. All right, A for advocacy. Let's go to the merits.
In this case, it really boils down to whether there was an order. That's the whole, all the plaintiff's claim in this case is there wasn't an order to hold the plaintiff, or there wasn't an order signed by what the claim has been a real judge. When you look at the record, there was an order entered by the General Sessions Court, the court that was required under the statute to issue these rulings.
Let me ask you something about that. I didn't see in the briefing or record or anything that the judicial commissioners were authorized or empowered to issue the kind of order they did. There's a statute saying that the commissioners are part of the General Sessions Court, but that, of course, all the employees of the court, in a sense, are part of the court. But that's about all it said. And I'm just wondering, is there a statute or court rule or even a court order that delineates and sets out what the powers of the judicial commissioners are?
That's a great question, Judge Clay. As you mentioned, Tennessee Code Annotated 40-5-204 does set up for the authority to use judicial commissioners.
Yes, but it doesn't say that they are authorized to exercise judicial authority. Doesn't really say what their powers might be or anything like that.
And excuse me for interrupting. I think the document that would point you to what you're looking for is document 104-8. It was filed with Vanderbilt's summary judgment memorandum, and it is the General Sessions Court report for 2017 through June of 2018. It's the period that covers this.
But
and basically,
I saw that, but that's almost like a PR statement. That's like the Chief Justice of the United States issues a year-end report. It doesn't have any judicial authority attached to it.
Just to be clear for the record, he means PR statement in an affectionate, positive sense.
Very much so.
I think that report shows, though, how the General Sessions Court has divided its task. And under the authority of the Metro Charter, it can assign different night courts in different sections. And this report helps show how it did that. And it shows that the night court is used to handle these involuntary emergency committals. And that they're the only section of the night court that handles these. And they do thousands of these a year. And this was not disputed by plaintiff at the trial court level, that this is the only division of General Sessions that handles these. And I'm understanding your point of the authority. You want a statute or something to cite to.
Is it a fair analogy to think of magistrates issuing warrants in the middle of the night?
I think it comes, that's what they've been given their authority to do so and delineated to do that power in that case at night. In this case, these night court magistrates or these judicial commissioners get to do that at all times. Now, even if there's some issue with this, it really boils down to also the reliance argument. Vanderbilt had a General Sessions court order. That's what the statute required. It needed a General Sessions order from the county, which it had. And if there's some issue with how General Sessions structured its court to allow only these judicial commissioners to sign these orders, because they're the only ones who did, Vanderbilt still was entitled to rely on a court order. It had no reason to say, well, I got this order from General Sessions, but did the person who signed it really have authority to do so? You're allowed to presume that, or our judicial system is just going to crumble if every time someone gets a court order, they have to question.
Are you aware of any instance prior to this case where this has been challenged?
I'm not aware, no. That this is the practice in Davidson County is that these commissioners sign it, and to my knowledge, this has never been challenged in our research. And I think it really comes down to you can rely on a court order, and if not, you have to start investigating, and you have to start going through these hoops that you're never going to be able to rely on any court order that comes out of General Sessions or any other court. If there's any other questions, I'm happy to answer, and if not, thank you for your time, and Vanderbilt requests that you affirm the lower court's ruling.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Tipton. Mr. Justice, you've got some rebuttal.
On this last point about the hospital just being, or people in general being allowed to rely on any order that they see, in Coffey versus Peterbilt of Nashville, the Tennessee Supreme Court basically said that that's not true, that if the order is facially lacking in jurisdiction, then you're not entitled to just rely on it.
And Judge Bush asked if anyone had ever raised this before. I mean, where's the law that would make it clear that this was wrong?
Well, I don't think that there's any defense raised that would need to be especially clear in terms of like qualified immunity. I don't think they have that defense, and they haven't cited anything like that.
I don't know the Tennessee case you're referring to, but the way you described it was that no, you don't get inoculated if it's apparent on the face of the order that there's a problem. Isn't that how you described it?
That is how I described it. In that case, it was an order taken from a different state that would not have complied with that state's rules of procedure. That was what was at issue in Coffey versus Peterbilt of Nashville. But in this case, it was an order that says on the front page of it that it's not being signed by a General Sessions judge. It's being signed by a judicial commissioner and or night court judge, who they know is not a General Sessions judge. In terms of what law defines...
Why can't there be a delegation? I mean, we have that in law quite a bit.
There can't be a delegation because the statute says it has to... It says if the General Sessions judge is not available, then you have to release the person in 24 hours. And it uses the words General Sessions judge and court, seemingly... uses those back-to-back, meaning they're talking about the same thing. In terms of a judicial commissioner's rightful authority, that is discussed. I don't have the statute right in front of me. I believe it's in Title 40, Chapter 5, Part 2, where it talks about what magistrates are allowed to do, and it says the judicial commissioner is a magistrate. And it talks about their authority to issue criminal arrest warrants, search warrants, things of that nature. And that's also discussed in State versus Bush, where it says a judicial commissioner is not a court.
Do you know how long they've been doing this?
I don't know. No, Your Honor. But as I said, I think it's just a local thing. I don't think anywhere else even does it, but I don't really know. And no, I don't.
Local know. As in just Vanderbilt or local as in Davidson County?
Local as in Davidson County.
Well, that's a pretty big area.
I guess, but I'm just saying, I don't know. But I mean, if the court were to just say they're allowed to do it, then no one will ever be allowed to challenge it again, despite the fact that the statute says you got to have the General Sessions.
Well, I mean, she was making the fair point. You're Vanderbilt. Your inclination is to think this is okay, and the longer this has been going on without anyone saying anything about it, per Judge Bush's question, it does favor them, I would think.
If you're Vanderbilt, I would submit you've got lawyers, and your lawyers are entitled to look up the law and see whether it's really okay, and if they get an order that they don't think is really an order from a real General Sessions judge/court, then they're not supposed to hold you for more than 24 hours, and they can maybe communicate that to the court and say, hey, we need an actual signature from a real judge or else we can't hold the person. I would just submit on this thing about Bing versus O'Brien. The court in O'Brien distinguished the fact that no shots were fired, no victims were present. If they're saying an ice cream truck came by four hours into the siege, then that still means that they already intruded on the house for 4 hours and turned off the air conditioner without any ice cream truck. So I would say there is no exigency, there was no probable cause. Unless Your Honors have any more questions, I ask that the judgment be reversed.
I don't think so. So thank you, Mr. Justice. Thank you to all three of you for your helpful briefs and arguments. We appreciate it.